Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. Thanks for listening to the Bookshop Podcast. I appreciate the notes I receive saying how much you enjoy the show. Creating a podcast is a lot of work. It takes hours to research guests, edit, produce, and market each episode. Many of you have contacted me wanting to financially support the work I do, so I've made it easy. To donate using PayPal, go to thebookshoppodcast.buzzsprout.com and click on the small blue heart at the top right of the homepage. You can also donate via Patreon. The link is on my website at www.mandyjacksonbeverly.com and click on the Bookshop Podcast. I love what I do, and I believe in keeping the magic of independent bookshops a reality and to support authors everywhere. Now, on with the show. In episode 18 of the Bookshop Podcast, I interviewed Ari Popper, a futurist with his own company, Sci Futures. Ari kindly introduced me to my next guest, and I'm excited to have him on the show today. I hope you enjoy the interview. Elliot Pepper is the author of Veil, Breach, Borderless, Bandwidth, Cumulus, Neon Fever Dream, and the Uncommon series, and his books have earned praise from Seth Godin, Kim Stanley Robinson, Malka Older, Cory Doctorow, Tim O'Reilly, Amal Imotar, and Eve Williams, as well as the New York Times Book Review, BBC, Popular Science, Business Week, San Francisco Magazine, Newsweek, IO9, Boing Boing, Publishers Weekly, and Ars Technica. Elliot is also the co-creator of the award-winning True Blue website and the critically acclaimed game Machine Learning President. His writing has appeared in The Verge, Tor.com, Harvard Business Review, Vice, 1-0, TechCrunch, Gen, and the Los Angeles Review of Books, and he has also given talks at Google, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Comic-Con, Niantic, Future in Review, Calcom, South by Southwest, and the Conference on World Affairs. Elliot lives in Oakland, California. Hi, Elliot, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a delight to be on.
It's great to have you here. Elliot, while you're a writer, you also spend time working in venture capital, contributing on the technological side. What is it that you do, and how do you manage your time so you're able to schedule time for writing and marketing?
Sure. Yeah. So I actually came into writing maybe from an unusual direction. Ever since I was a kid, I've been a huge bookworm. So I was the kid who would get lost in the library stacks or literally hide in, among the shelves of our local independent bookstore so that my parents couldn't find me to take me home. So I've always been a huge reader, but I never aspired to be a writer or a novelist. After college, I started working in tech startups, and I was really enamored with the culture of wanting to try to contribute something to the world, of trying to build a better future, and sort of the small teams that are often very dysfunctional, but that get together to try to make something new, to contribute something to the culture and society. And I always found that sort of ethic really interesting and compelling. And so my career started out as working in a bunch of different startups. Eventually, I worked within a venture capital firm, helping to build the startups in their portfolio. And one thing I noticed along the way was that there was all of this human drama happening, just like, I don't know, like doing a startup is somewhat similar to the typical sort of Star Wars movie where you have a small band of misfits that like have some different idea for how the world should work and then are trying to make it happen, but then inevitably totally mess up along the way. So there was all this human drama happening, and I didn't really see that getting captured in much of the writing about startups. So, you know, if you imagine like what's a book you could imagine about startups, it's going to be some business book, right? And typically those are like a successful executive who goes back and writes about their lessons learned. And while that can be really illuminating, it's almost always sort of memoir style, and they're trying to take out these sort of like clean, like, oh, this is how the world works kind of ideas. When the reality of doing it is that it's a total mess and no one knows what they're really doing, and you're just trying your best. And often you have personalities that get in the way of each other, and like money won or lost and relationships that fall apart and all that. And so I just thought, wow, this would be such a compelling scenery for fiction, right? That like there are so many stories happening here. And it seems like a novel might be a really interesting way to explore the human experience of trying to make a change in the world. And I couldn't really find that book to read. And so I decided if I can't find it to read, maybe I'll try to write it. And that's how I started writing fiction, is I sat down and started to write that book. And then that turned into a trilogy. And I just really enjoyed the writing process. And so that has turned into it totally set my career on a different trajectory. And I started writing fiction as my primary thing. I left the venture capital firm, and I've been really focused on the books ever since. But because I have this sort of alternate history origin story of doing this kind of work, and because a lot of my books sort of riff on themes in the present to imagine these near futures, it turns out that like that kind of thinking is actually very relevant to people who are either building something to try to change the future or betting on particular futures. And so even though I now spend most of my time writing books and publishing them, and as you said, marketing, you know, the job of building an audience as a writer, I still occasionally consult with companies that want to bring me in for a creative commission or for some advisory work to help them think through, basically to like inject a little bit more like outside the box imagination into the kinds of initiatives that they're kicking off.
And how does science fiction relate to issues confronted by venture capitalists, startups, etc.? And I'd like to read a quote of yours, which I love. Predicting versus thinking differently about the present. Could you extend a little on that, please?
Of course, sure. So, yeah, so there are a couple of different interrelated relationships between science fiction and, I'd say, like real world technology. So whether you're a hacker working on a program or a scientist working in a lab, or you're a venture capital investor who's investing in startups trying to commercialize new technology, there's a lot of cultural resonance between science fiction that tells stories that involve technology and how it shapes our lives, and then people building technology that how it shapes our lives. So a good example of this is of course, now that I need his name, I'm completely blanking on his name. But there's a world-renowned paleontologist who discovered the largest known dinosaur, which was he discovered in Patagonia. This was a couple decades ago. He's currently one of the leading living paleontologists who's studied fossils and dinosaurs. And one of the things he said that really stuck with me was that Jurassic Park, the movie Jurassic Park, is more important to paleontology than any paper that's been written in the past 40 years. And the reason is not that the science is right? I mean, of course, it's a movie, like it's a Hollywood movie, like the science is not right. I mean, there's some interesting ideas in the story, but like clearly it's not technically accurate. But so many of his graduate students, of these new paleontologists, were inspired to embark on that career because they watched that film when they were a kid, right? And that as a field, paleontology owes an enormous amount to Jurassic Park, which is so sort of like ironic, right? Like you'd almost think of a paleontologist tearing it down, saying like, oh, this is what's wrong with the movie, right? But in fact, there's this sort of a flywheel that happens where you have these stories that talk about the role that technology plays in our culture, and that can be an inspiration for people who want to go into it. It can be a warning, right? For example, Cory Doctorow's book, Little Brother, which came out maybe 15 years ago. I'd say it's one of the most important books after Orwell's 1984 when it comes to popularizing the idea of state surveillance and understanding how the internet impacts surveillance in our culture. And that book, if you watch the documentary that was made about Edward Snowden in the wake of his whistleblowing, one of the few items that Snowden brought with him when he fled the country to issue his revelations to the world was his copy of Cory Doctorow's Little Brother, right? So you can see how there's this interplay. And there are a million examples here. Many people who work in technology can cite stories that inspired them or that shape how they think about the world. And obviously, the reverse is also true. If you write science fiction, you're in many ways, like when I go to write science fiction, it's basically about the present. Like I'm just trying to find the weird bits that I find surprising or interesting that I just see in the world right now, and then I spin them out. And so that brings us to your question, which is about prediction versus finding a new lens on our present world. I get asked a lot about how I predict the future, right? And many science fiction writers get this question, right? Like, how do you come up with the futures you're writing about? And same in the venture capital or the sort of technology community, right? So people will ask, how are you so prescient, right? They will ask, like, people who are making these bets on the future. And the answer is that that no one is prescient. The future is fundamentally unknowable. But the thing that makes science fiction useful, if you are trying to understand how the world works, is that it makes your thinking more flexible. And the way to make sense of this is that, like, the status quo is a huge constraint on every human's thinking. So as an example, I was born in Oakland, California, and growing up, I took things like buses, roads, sewer systems, money, local, state, and federal governments for granted. All of those things, they're part of the fabric of the world I was born into. And so to me, they seem like a given, right? When in fact, all of those things are human inventions, right? Are like everything from our electrical grid to our electoral system are human inventions. And you can see when, you know, those things become visible when they break, right? So with COVID, we saw, for example, all the breakdowns in the food system, right? Like, you know, supply chains and farmers and everything there. But we usually take those for granted. And so one thing that I find, imaginative fiction to be really, really useful for is it gives you a different set of givens. Right. So now you're entering this imagined world where the rules are different. The systems that shape the lives of the characters are actually different than the systems that you live within in your regular life. So just like when you travel to a foreign country for the first time and then you return home and you notice all of these things that you had never noticed before because you took them for granted, fiction can do the same thing. And so often when people think about, wait, prescriptive or is it predictive? The answer is no, that's actually not why it's interesting. The reason why it's interesting if you're trying to make better decisions in the present is that it can widen the scope of your thinking.
That was a great explanation. Thank you. Now, your books fall into subgenres of techno thrillers, cyberpunk, financial thrillers, and hard science fiction, which is a category of science fiction characterized by concern for scientific accuracy and logic. How difficult was it for you to begin writing fictional stories, switching over from logical constructive thinking to creating stories set in the future?
Okay, so let me start with where you started, with the genres. And every writer will tell you that genre is both important and easily confused, right? Because genre helps readers make sense of what to expect from a story. But at least for me, I never think of myself as writing within a specific genre. So the way that I think of my own work is simply that I like telling human stories, character-driven stories that make you think, that adventures that leave you changed, that and that's how I go into it. And that those subgenres that you mentioned may be how the market classifies the books at the end of the day, but it's really different from the reader and the writer sort of side of the spectrum. And I'm always surprised at how reviewers categorize my books differently. I've had reviewers review my books from the frame of like of literary fiction, and also from the frame of like a straight like airport thriller, and also from the frame of science fiction, which I always find really fascinating as a writer. Be like, oh wow, like I didn't really have preconceptions here, but everyone is drawing their own truth from a story, which I just find to be one of the beauties of fiction, right? Is that the reader brings half of it to the table, at least half of it. So that's one piece. And then the second part of your question was about sort of analytical versus imaginative thinking, basically. And I think that there is a big gap here. Like everyone who's listening, we all have these situations in our lives where we're trying to figure out like, what's the best decision to make in my work today? Right? Or what do I do with my savings? Or, you know, what have you? And a lot of the times the answers to those questions are to look at what's worked before and then try to follow that next step. For example, you know, if you're trying to figure out what to do with your savings, look at what your savings did last year and then figure that out for next year, right? And that decision-making framework is how most people make decisions all the time, right? Like if you imagine the mayor of your town, when they have to decide what to do about a certain policy decision, usually the first thing they do is they say, well, what was done before, right? And then they go from there. And that's that kind of analytical framework of just trying to sort of project the past into the future is how most policies are made. It's how most business decisions are made. It's just that's sort of the reality of that kind of analytical thinking. It's mostly about just examining the world and pressing fast forward. And writing fiction is quite different. I actually find that writing fiction is much more similar to improv acting, where rather than trying to be very analytical about a whole bunch of external research, you're actually just trying to improvise in the moment something that's compelling to others, right? Something that can invite other people into your imagination. I actually think of writing very much as a performance art. I find that I get as much inspiration to do like professional performance art as I do from other writers. Because I like to think of novels as stories, just like you would that have been told for tens of thousands of years, like around fires, right? And so what that means is that the novel is a written record of a story, just as if you record a musician, the recording is different than the performance in the studio that yielded the recording. And so I've always found that to be a really interesting, like, angle that helps me access that creative mindset as a writer.
Yeah, and I'll add to that. I find the multi-sub-genre thing, it drives me nuts.
I agree.
Because every book has a touch of mystery or romance or love. And to have to categorize a book to fit it into a slot, especially one that you've spent years writing, is frustrating and also a little bit debilitating.
So that's really interesting. And one thing that makes me think about, or that I've realized over the course of, you know, putting different books out, is I used to be very frustrated by genre because of what you just said. Like every book is intersectional, right? There's no such thing as a book that's perfectly in one genre. So it feels constraining as the writer to pretend that your book really is only in one category. So that used to really frustrate me. And then I realized, I started thinking about it a little differently, which has been, it still frustrates me, but it's been a little bit helpful. And that is that I started just thinking about it as any writer can tell you, as I know you know, right? If you meet someone, a stranger, a friend of a friend or whatever, and they say, oh, what do you do? And you say, oh, I'm an author. Their first question is, well, what do you write, right? Like, have I read it? and you have to give an answer. And no matter what, like you're in a conversation at a dinner party, or I guess during COVID on Zoom, maybe, I don't know. But your answer clearly can't be comprehensive. You're going to drive everyone bonkers and bore the hell out of them, right? You can't actually explain the context for everything you're doing. No, you need to be able to answer in like 1 to 3 sentences, right? To give them a flavor of, you know, a starting point for what your work is, so that if they are the right kind of person for it, they will then want to ask for more. They will then want to ask the next question or look into it or, you know, look you up afterwards and pick up the book or whatever. And that if they're not the right person, that just as helpful, it allows them to ignore it from then on, right? So in fact, genre is simply a tool for coming up with that first sentence where you can help the right people opt in because they are the right people for this story, or the right people opt out. And so that's how I try to think about it now. I won't say that it has solved my frustration, but it is a little bit helpful that I'm like, okay, like I need to think about this from the reader's perspective, not from mine.
That's a good strategy. I'm going to have to remember that. Now, while your books have strong plots, they seem to be driven by character, and a majority of your books feature female protagonists. Was this planned or organic?
Totally organic. Not planned at all. Yeah. Really, when I'm working on a new story, it's sort of like a matter of first collecting dots and then connecting them. So like the collecting phase is really, I'll just have random ideas. It might be a moment, like an emotional moment. It might be a scene. It might be a plot point that's very externally driven. It might be an arc, like a lesson that someone might learn, or an underlying theme that they come to realize through the course of struggle. It might be a weird random observation about the world or about myself that it's just like, oh wow, like I didn't really think about this before. This is a, you know, a friend says something to you and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I do that. Right. And so all of those things sort of, I let them ferment. And then when I'm sitting down to write a story, I basically try to stir them all up and see what comes out. And so like when I'm deciding on a protagonist or major characters, whether they're point of view characters or not, like I don't have ulterior motives for them. I'm really just trying to find, like, for whatever reason, given these other conditions, this is the person that seems to fit. And so I'd say that at least consciously, I don't have any, there was no like plan around like the identity of my main characters, like their gender, their race, their cultural background or anything. It's just been more like, oh, what makes sense for this story?
And do you find that once you acknowledge your characters, they're persistent in your ear until the story is done?
Like the thing that I find really magical about both reading and writing novels is that basically the characters become friends. Like that's how they feel to me. It feels like they're friends. And just like a friend, I want to get to know them better. I want to understand what drives them. I want to see them grow. I want to, you know, help them or whatever. And so usually for me at the beginning of a story, I don't know them very well. It's like going on a first date or, you know, meeting a friend for a first time. You're sort of like trying to figure each other out. And then once I get, you know, towards the middle and then the end of a story, they do feel like friends. And I'm often, there's this sort of a really bittersweet feeling when I reach the end of a rough draft, because editing is different, right? You already have things on the page. You still get to do new writing, but to me, it feels quite different. So when I'm nearing the end of a rough draft, I have this bittersweet feeling where I'm thrilled as a writer to be nearing the end of a big project, but also really sort of sad that I'm letting these people go.
I completely agree. And I think the endings are even more difficult when you've finished writing a series, because those friends, as you say, have been with you for so long. It's hard to let them go.
Absolutely. And honestly, I feel the same way when I read a novel that really touches me. You know, I'm nearing the end of the book and I'm like 90% of the way through and I'm like, oh no, like I want to know what happens. I care about these people so much, but then I don't get to hang out with them anymore, right?
Yeah, I'm a big rereader specifically for that reason. Let's talk about publishing. Your first book was through FG Press at the Foundry Group. And when they closed, you self-published. And later your books, Breach, Bandwidth and Borderless, were published by 47 North. For your latest book, Veil, published in May 2020, you chose to self-publish. Why?
Yeah. So I have 9 novels out. The first 2 were with FG Press. And for listeners, that was a small press, an independent small press, that was relatively short-lived. So it shut down a few years after my first books came out. And they were very good about it and reverted all the rights to all their authors. And so you could choose what to do with your books going forward. And I chose to self-publish mine. And then I subsequently self-published 3 additional novels. Then 47 North is part of Amazon Publishing. And an acquiring editor from 47 North reached out to me directly and said, hey, I read one of your books. I really liked it. Would you be interested in doing something with us? And that led to the 3-book deal that became the Bandwidth, Borderless, and Breach. And then this latest book, which came out in May, Veil, I once again self-published. So, you know, longtime listeners of your show will probably realize that is a somewhat unusual CV for an author. To a certain extent, every author has an unusual CV. So that it's not that it's that unusual, but when I started writing for fun as a side project, purely for personal fulfillment. And then as I was working on it, I started to really enjoy myself. And I thought, wow, you know, who knows? Maybe there are other people like me, right, who would appreciate this story. And so it would be cool to find them. I started researching, what kind of publishing path should I take? And there are many publishing paths you can take. The traditional route would be, if you wrote your first novel, would be to take the manuscript and then solicit literary agents who would then, if you convinced one to represent you, they would then go on to sell the manuscript to a publisher, and then that would go from there. And frankly, when I was working on my first manuscript, this path did not seem appealing, because when I talk to many authors, partially this is just sort of a result of 20th century contracts that established cultural norms in the industry. But it's pretty hard to get a good book deal for a debut novel. It also takes a lot of calendar time. Pitching agents with a debut novel fiction manuscript is a lot of work. And everyone has heard those stories about, I got rejected by 100 people, and then finally someone said yes, right? And then that's just to get the agent. They're your salesperson. Right. Then you have to go on and do the same process again with the publisher. So, typically first you have to write the whole manuscript, and then you have to go through that process, which usually takes years. And so that would mean that no one would read your book for many years after you had even finished the first manuscript. And frankly, that didn't appeal to me. I think partially this is that I grew up with the internet. And so I'm so used to being able to put your work out there. Like if you make something, share it with the right people, period. Right. And then you'll figure out the rest later. And so my perspective was always that I wanted to invest my time as a writer, not in soliciting industry support or partnership, but rather in developing my craft and building my own audience directly. And that those were the two places where I wanted to invest my creative time. And so I did. So in fact, even the first two books with FG Press, I was planning on self-publishing them because I knew that I couldn't get a good book deal without an agent. And I wasn't interested in soliciting that. I shared the rough draft manuscript with a friend just for feedback because I thought he would really like it. And it turned out that he was one of the investors in FG Press. And so they made an offer on that book to me directly without any... Like, I wasn't even expecting it. Like, he came back. I was expecting him to say, well, I liked this, but I hated that, right? And instead, he came back and said, hey, would you be interested in publishing with us? So it was very unusual. And so that's really how my career has played out. My focus has always been, how can I make every story I tell better than the last? And how can I share... I don't mean only the prose. I mean every part of it, because to me as a reader, I think of a book as a holistic experience. And so when I self-publish, I spend a lot, like I invest substantial amounts of money hiring a top-notch team, and I'm trying to compete directly with the production values of Penguin Random House, right? So that a reader would never know the difference between one of my books and a book that they would buy, you know, from Random House. That's how I approach self-publishing. So, you know, for me, I wanted to invest all of my time in that and in building the relationship with the readers who were the right people for my books. And so my career has really been a result of that. And then I've occasionally done these partnerships, but they've actually, so far, they've exclusively been inbound. So, for example, the trilogy you mentioned that was with 47 North, I didn't have an agent and I didn't solicit it. It was an acquiring editor emailing me. And then I hired an IP attorney and negotiated the contract myself with them. And I've done a number of adaptation deals the same way. So I've had folks coming to me. One of them turned one of my novels into a digital serial that like had animations and art and all these extras and all that kind of stuff. And again, they reached out and I hired my IP attorney and we went through and negotiated the contract.
One thing's for sure, there are many ways to publish a book, whether it be traditional, small, medium press, hybrid publishing, or indie publishing. And often it's about each individual book.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll be really clear here. I have no philosophical loyalty to any publishing path. To me, the only thing I care about is sharing work I'm proud of with people I care about. Like, that's the only thing I care. That's the only thing that matters to me. So I am completely, every book I write, I am 100% opportunistic with it. In terms of publishing path. So I decide how to publish a book based on that book and the conditions around it, right? I think that if you get the right kind of deal with one of the large publishers, it can be a great thing. And I have many traditionally published friends who are very happy with their publisher relationship and many who aren't, right? But I also know many indies who are happy or unhappy, right? So I don't think that there is a right publishing path, not only for every author, but even for every book. Like I really think that it's like, it's really conditional. And so, you know, as an author, I really treat it as, okay, who is there a partner who would be good for this book? And that's how I think about it. And I have, although I've been represented by two agents in the past on the lit side and then a few others on the film TV side, but actually none of them have ever sold a book for me, interestingly. So I don't know. I mean, like, and but they were both wonderful people. We enjoyed working together. We learned a lot from each other. They're great. I think that I am very sensitive to the fact that I often fall into the rabbit hole of nerding out on like publishing systems and tools and like that thing, because I find it fascinating, but also that isn't what really matters. That those are the logistics by which a story reaches a person. And so I really just care, like I try to keep my North Star on that. And I think that, you know, in today's world, as an author, part of what readers are looking like part of your job is to help your stories reach the right people. So yes, can a publisher help with that? They can, but like it's your job to partner with them and make sure that that actually happens. And like getting a book deal is not the answer to that. It's just like, you know, you're ultimately the one responsible for crossing that gap. And if you can identify a good team to help you do it, more power to you. But like the buck still falls to you at the end of the day.
That's for sure. Can you share with us the success you had with your book Cumulus and how quickly that happened? And maybe touch on the cult following in Silicon Valley, because I love this story.
Okay, so I self-published Cumulus in May of 2016. And when you self-publish a book, or you know, indie publish, whatever term you want to use for it, your launch day is not what is not a like a Hollywood premiere, right? You don't have like tens of millions of dollars in marketing supporting it. And so it's a very humble experience. It's now people can choose to buy your book if they want it. And everything else is whatever you've lined up, right? So like my typical launch day is I have a newsletter that's all about the best books I read. So it's like a monthly reading recommendation newsletter, and it's wonderful. It's a lot of fun. So it's basically like a book club with a few thousand members. So when I have a new book come out, I send an email to them, letting them know that it's out. I also I have a blog, and so I publish a blog post giving some detail about the creative process behind the book and why you might enjoy reading it. And obviously I like announce it on social media. And then, you know, sometimes I've sent out review copies to people and hopefully they will choose, if they like it, maybe they will choose to share it with their audiences. But that's what my typical launch day is. So when I woke up the morning that Cumulus came out, it was a completely normal morning. I had granola and coffee. And so I was, you know, eating my granola and drinking my coffee, and I look at my phone, I like look at my email inbox, and at the top of the email inbox was an email where the subject, you know, like you can see the subject line, and the subject line was Cumulus Film TV Rights Inquiry, and it was from a major film TV production company that had, you know, that's put out like many Netflix shows and films. And I was like, that's what? Like, this is really weird. And then as I was watching, another one came in, and it was also Film TV Rights, Cumulus Film TV Rights Inquiry from a different production company. And then basically as I was eating breakfast, a whole pile of these inquiries came in from both on the film TV side and also on the agent, like literary agents reaching out like, hey, like, are you represented? What, you know, what are you working on next? Like this kind of thing. And I was so it's a great like ego experience, right? Like, or you feel, it makes you feel special to like see your inbox like that. But I was like, this is really strange. Like, why is this happening? And so I'm reading the emails and they're all like, we're really excited about your new book. Like what, you know, like, what are you working on now? Or like who, you know, like who owns the rights to it? And I'm like, I own all the rights. Like I just published it this morning. And I'm also reading them thinking, obviously these people haven't read the book, right? I mean, it just came out today. Like there's no way they've read the book. So why is this happening? And it wasn't until a few hours later that I figured out what was happening, which is that a friend texted me a screenshot of Reddit, which I didn't use at the time. And some reader had taken a review that was published on Ars Technica, which is sort of like Wired magazine, but a little geekier. And the review was, I think what was the title of the review? Cumulus is your new favorite near future dystopian novel or something like that. Like that was approximately the title of the review. And someone had posted it on Reddit Books, which is this, you know, online community of millions of people. And for whatever reason, it had trended. So it hit the front page of all of Reddit, which was driving thousands of people to discover the book and see this review, which was very positive. The reviewer loved the book. So they all read the review, and then it was like the sales were off the charts. I mean, it was selling thousands of copies. And that's a self-published book on the first day it comes out. Usually with self-published work, you're looking for word of mouth to grow your sales over time. So it's really unusual that on day one, this would happen. And so all of these folks whose job it is to scout for new potential, you know, opportunities for stories that are sort of like hitting a zeitgeist or whatever, that's why they were reaching out. So they were trying to look for, hey, you know, what are the stories that people seem to like that don't yet have all of their sort of like rights deals in place? And that's what was driving those inbound emails. So I was shocked. And it was obviously delightful. And I think that, you know, like I drew two lessons from the experience, which was, and it was really interesting actually, because then I started following up with all of these production companies and publishers and agents. And then, you know, a few minutes ago, we talked about what it's like for a debut novelist to try to get representation. And this, suddenly the tables had completely turned. I was receiving inbound offers of representation from many literary agencies that were at the top of their field. And so then it was a question of me interviewing the agents to say, who do I think would be the best fit? And so it was why I wanted to spend so much time focusing on craft and building an audience, because that's what publishers want at the end of the day, right? They want a good book that people will buy and like. So if you start producing that, suddenly the dynamics of your in the industry shift, and you can get really different, get yourself in very different kinds of situations. You know, the lessons I drew from that experience was, one, how random it was. Right? Like I didn't use Reddit. I didn't know that the review had been published. I certainly had no idea that it was trending until a different friend let me know. That was such a random internet alignment of forces that could never have been engineered. It really was humbling in terms of my respect for how much luck is involved in any kind of like cultural resonance or success, right? Like that, you know, I've tried many different ways to reach people over the years and many different approaches to marketing. And frankly, nothing I've ever done with intention has come even close to that random event. But then like the second thing that is more actionable for listeners, if they are writers or if they're publishers, right? Or frankly, anyone who's trying to put work into the world and help connect with the right people, is that one, you have to have this enormous respect for luck and just for the fact that you cannot control or engineer outcomes. But that you can control inputs. So once I did discover that, you know, once my friend did text me and I saw that this was happening, I was like, oh, okay, let me piece together what led to this. So months before, like 6 months earlier, I went to a salon, like a little cultural event I had a friend, he creates, it's actually super cool. He is a linguist who creates fake languages for TV shows. So he's created on The Expanse, the TV show, he created the Belter language. He's worked on various major franchises to create these cool languages. And he was doing an event at a bar in Oakland where he was being interviewed for, you know, just like as a cool, like little cultural event. And I wanted to go support him. And so I attended this event. And before the event, I'm sitting at the bar and I'm ordering a beer and I start chatting with the person next to me. I'm like, what do you do? And he's like, oh, I'm a writer. And I was like, oh, what do you write? And turns out he's a journalist for Ars Technica. He writes about technology and surveillance and that kind of stuff. Really cool guy, Cyrus Farivar. And he's like, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I'm also a writer. And he's like, what are you working on? And I started describing Cumulus, which was at that point, it was the rough draft. I was like in edits on the rough draft. And so I start describing the story and he stops me and he says, wait a minute, do you mean, and then he goes on to name characters and describe details from the rough draft. And I was so shocked. I was like, you're a stranger I met at a bar. The only people who have seen this Word document are like maybe 10 people with whom I've shared it. So like editors, right? A few beta readers who are friends who give me notes on early drafts. And like, that's about it, right? So like, how could a stranger possibly know the details of this unpublished story? And he says, oh, I had breakfast yesterday with Tim O'Reilly. And Tim runs O'Reilly Media. They're actually a book publisher. They do mostly educational and technical books. And I had shared, Tim O'Reilly, the previous year, had written an essay about economic inequality in the Bay Area and sort of the history of it and what was contributing to it. That was a big theme in the story of Cumulus. And so I had emailed Tim and saying like, I loved your essay. I think you might really enjoy this. Would you like to read an early draft? And he was like, sure. And that's all I heard, right? So I had shared an early draft with him a month before. And he had had lunch with Cyrus, breakfast, and told him about this science fiction book he was loving. And Cyrus was like, oh my God, I need to read it. Can you send me a review copy? And I was like, I don't even have review copies yet. Like, we're in edits, right? But like, sure, I'll send you one, you know, give me your email and I'll send it to you when they're ready. And so I just fulfilled that promise. Like a couple months later, when the review copies were ready, I sent one to him and he was like, great, I'm looking forward to reading it. And then he published that review the day it came out. Some reader of his posted it on Reddit and it went viral. So like, while I could never have engineered any of that, what I was doing as a writer is I was trying to do my best work. And then I was genuinely trying to share it with like people who I had very specific personal reasons to think it would mean something to them. So like Tim O'Reilly, who was sort of the start of this progression, you know, I know he likes science fiction. He writes about the themes that the book grapples with all the time. And I just thought he would legitimately enjoy the story. That's why I emailed him. And that's sort of what triggered that weird series of events. So again, like takeaways from that whole anecdote for me were, one, you can't control outcomes, so don't try to. And instead, focus your energy where it can make a difference, which is on controlling your inputs, doing your best work, and then, you know, trying to help the right people to genuinely connect with it.
What I got from your story is that you never lost focus of what you were doing, which was writing this book to the best of your ability. And then you were sharing it with someone who was genuinely interested in the topic. And this is followed by a series of synchronistic events, just fabulous. You mentioned earlier that every month you share a personal email talking about the books you've read. But what is one book, apart from one of your own, you'd like to see more people reading?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I like that question because it means that I can't choose the obvious answer. Because it needs to be a book that is underappreciated. Oh, that's so good. And this is actually perfect because tomorrow I'm sending out my favorite books from last year. So every month I send out these reading recommendations, and then every year I go back through and I choose my very favorites and send those out as like the best books I read in in 2020. I'm going to pull it up in front of me right now, and then I can, then I'll really be able to answer your question well. Okay. So I'm going to give you two different recommendations for one fiction and one nonfiction that I think you're based on our conversation today, I think that people would really sort of appreciate. Last year, before COVID hit, I visited my aunt who lives in Canada and in British Columbia. And she handed me this tattered paperback, like clearly decades old. And it has this very strange, like psychedelic cover. And I was sort of like, what is this? And she was like, no, seriously, you'll like it. And it's called Little Big by John Crowley. And so I started reading this book, and I clearly had no idea what to expect. I didn't know anything about the author or the story. And it was amazing. It's this kaleidoscopic epic. It involves all of these imaginative elements, almost this like fairy kingdom. And so it has these elements of a folktale or a fairy tale, but it's all woven through a sort of very comprehensive modern novel with four adults with tons of emotional depth. And I just found that it really boggled my mind and heart simultaneously. So, you know, I think it was originally published in 1968 or something around there. And so I think that probably many people listening haven't read it, and that it was totally extraordinary. It made me rethink what sort of the whole sort of like fantasy and science, like how imagination can be used in fiction in a really compelling, creative way. So I think that would be a really wonderful recommendation. And it's a perfect book for winter when, you know, it's colder and you want to curl up inside with a book. This is a really great one. You can completely lose yourself in it. And so that's one. And then another, because we've spent quite a bit of this conversation talking about publishing, right? Not just reading and writing, but actually the mechanics of publishing and you know, sort of pulling back the curtain on how books get into your hands. There was a really wonderful book published over the summer by Anne Trebeck, which is called So You Want to Publish a Book. And it's a concise, very practical guide to the book publishing industry, written by the founder of a small press in the Midwest. And Anne does just a wonderful job of avoiding, like being able to speak to the underlying realities of book publishing without getting lost in acronyms or sort of rabbit holes or, you know, like the things that would be, that are easy for any industry insider to sort of get lost in. So if you are an author trying to figure out, how do I make sense of this weird world? Or if you're in publishing professionally in any way, if you're an agent, if you're an editor, but also if you're just a curious reader, if like me, you were one of those people who would always get lost in the library stacks as a kid and you're curious about like what's inside the sausage factory, this is a really wonderful glimpse into that. That's very accessible. It's short, it's, you know, it's clear, it's well-written. And I think it would be really useful probably for many of your listeners.
Two wonderful choices. Thank you. Elliot, where can listeners find you?
Sure. Yeah. Just myname.com. If you just Google my name, my website will pop up. It's elliotpepper.com and ELIOTPEPER. The best way to connect with me is to subscribe to that monthly newsletter that we were just talking about, or subscribe to my blog. Both of those are good ways to keep in touch. And then if you have questions or if this conversation prompts any follow-up questions that you'd want to ask me, just find me on Twitter, because that's probably the easiest place, at Elliot Pepper, and I'm happy to field any follow-ups.
And is Twitter the main social media platform you use?
That's where I'm most active. I mean, I am on Facebook and LinkedIn, I guess, you know, like I and Instagram, but I don't really use them. I've always really found that you want to double down on the things where, on communities where you're really a contributor and where you connect with organically, like not to try to be everywhere. And for me, I've actually been shocked at how many real world friendships I've found through Twitter. It's really a special community. So that's the place where I'm most active. And so if you're active there too, hop on. And if you're not, just email me. Sign up for my newsletter, my blog, and just hit reply, and we can have a correspondence there.
Elliot, I've thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show. You're a great speaker, and I love hearing all of your ideas and insight into publishing, writing, and just your philosophical views on technology too. So thank you so much, and I'd love to have you back.
Well, thanks so much. You have great questions that really push me to expand my thinking, and I really appreciate it.
And thank you for listening. Remember, buy local, read global, support your local indie bookshop. I'll see you around the corner. For updates about the show, make sure to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Mandy Jackson Beverly.